listening to episode 146 of Flick Fights, the official podcast of FlickChart.com. Hello, Flick Charters, and welcome to Flick Fights, the official Flick Chart podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Chase.
I'm Hannah Kiefer.
And I'm Doug Van Hollen.
And we're here to sort through the best movies of all time, two at a time, head to head. And as we pick the better film between each pair, our chart better represents all of our collective taste in movies. If you're not already on FlickChart, head over to FlickChart.com, sign up for free, and get started by ranking all your favorite movies on an account of your very own. On this episode, we're going to be adding the Steven Spielberg film Catch Me If You Can to the chart. So let's go ahead and get into some fights in the Thunderdome.
Two men, hand to hand. No jury, no appeal, no parole. Two men enter, one man leaves.
Weapons?
Anything is possible. Chance decides.
Thunderdome. How do I get in there?
That's easy. Pick a fight.
Okay, so first up we have District 9 against Flubber. It's just fun to say. So Flubber is from 1997, and it is a quasi-remake of it's kind of like The Nutty Professor, but not quite.
The Absent-Minded Professor.
That's correct. Originally it was a, why is his name escaping my head?
My Three Sons.
Jerry Lewis was the original.
No, that's The Nutty Professor.
Actor. Okay, I'm getting this completely wrong.
I don't know.
Fred McMurray.
Okay. seen that one. I've only seen this one. So scratch all that.
It's not good. It's not a good enough movie to worry about the trivia for.
About its long storied history in the film canon.
Yeah. So it's Robin Williams as a crazy professor comes up with Flubber, which is sort of a non-Newtonian fluid bouncy stuff, and it's a kid's movie, and that's about what I remember about it. It's pretty forgettable, and it's up against District 9, which is very memorable for all the reasons that we've talked about, whether it's the pacing, the character arc, the great CG, the social commentary. It's kind of a no-brainer, right?
Yeah. Flubber, the best part about that movie is the fact that Flubber is fun to say. Like, that's about it. The original movie, Absent-Minded Professor, is cute. It's incredibly silly, but it's got kind of a fun, charming nature to it. Flubber is a mess, yeah. And I remember when I watched it, the thing that bugged me the most was that he has a robot that falls in love with him. And I was like, where is this even coming from? Whoa. This is the stupidest plot point I've ever heard. And it was terrible. And it's just messy. It's a really cruddy remake that takes all the fun of the original and the creativity of the original, which spent most of its time like playing around with what Flubber could do. Mm-hmm. And like, it was just fun to watch every scene and say, oh, we just figured out how to do this with it. And that was fun. It was creative and playful, and this version was just sucked all the fun out of it and replaced it with zaniness for the sake of zaniness. And District 9 is an actually very, very good movie, and so there's no way that Flubber is going to take this for me.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that the main thing I remember about Flubber is that they imbued it with consciousness, that it had like a little attitude to it. I remember there was a really bizarre swing dance number in the middle where different blobs of Flubber were swing dancing with each other. Cause this is in, 97.
Oh my gosh.
This is the height of the neo swing revolution.
Right.
And it was just a big mistake.
And they've done, like, they did things with Flubber with people dancing in the original, but that was just people had it on their shoes and were, like, bouncing all over the place, and which was fun in and of itself. You don't need the Flubber itself to be dancing on its own.
Exactly. I mean, and I think this may be, you know, this may be the dichotomy between practical effects and CG. You know, all of the Flubber effects in 1961's The Absent-Minded Professor, it was just, you know, practical effects and strings, and it was fun and light. And somehow when they remade it, they tried to give it, like, all this drama, and with that really bizarre love story, which, you know, I had a lot more questions than it answered there, frankly. Yeah. And
it was not ready to address something with, like, all the questions of what constitutes life and intelligence. It was not prepared to answer those questions.
All right. Well, it sounds like we're absolutely going to go for District 9 over Flubber. All right. Next up, we have Dawn of the Dead. From 2004, this is the remake of Dawn of the Dead, against Raising Arizona from 1987. So Raising Arizona is the Nick Cage, Coen Brothers sort of dark comedy. And Dawn of the Dead is the Zack Snyder version of Dawn of the Dead, the more modern take on the zombie story. A lot of people are huge fans of Raising Arizona. They think it's, you know, a modern comedy masterpiece. But when I watched it, I wasn't that overjoyed with it. I felt like it was missing something, and I'm not really quite sure exactly what. But I don't know if the humor just wasn't my style, or I didn't like the way the characters interacted with each other. I don't know. There was something that didn't really click for me. Dawn of the Dead, same kind of thing. It's almost an unnecessary film. A little bit too on the nose, a little bit too cutesy with some of the gags that they tried to pull off. And it wasn't scary in the slightest bit. It was more just kind of fun and almost like an action film rather than a horror film. So I don't know. I guess I'd probably pick Dawn of the Dead if I had to choose one between these two, but it would be close because I'm not that hot on either one. So what do you guys think of these films?
Yeah, I feel very similarly. I mean, these are two films that have fandoms that I've never really participated in. The big scandal of Dawn of the Dead was the fast zombies, and I don't particularly have a problem with that. I mean, I think that they used the zombie trope effectively in that the zombies functioned the way that they're supposed to, which is, you know, this MacGuffin that traps you inside, right? That's its purpose. Mm-hmm. But I think that it suffers for me because of my love of the original, and that's no fault of this film's, one could argue, but it could also mean that like it didn't need to be made. And I have a feeling like that this was an era in the early 2000s where there was a lot of those unnecessary remakes of things that were really beloved to me.
Like the Psycho remake.
Man, like, come on. Like, what's going on? Like,
why would you do that?
Like, this movie had a budget of $26 million. Like, this $26 million could have made like three other really original, interesting films, unlike what we have here. You know, so it's not that it's a bad film. I mean, I feel like if I hadn't seen the original, or if, you know, if the culture hadn't seen the original, like it's okay. You know, given zombie film is probably kind of interesting. There's very few truly boring or uninteresting zombie films, in my opinion. But what's going to make Raising Arizona take this for me is that Raising Arizona is clever and innovative. I think that it has a really interesting blend of just a lot of dialogue and banter for kind of a desert crime movie where you wouldn't necessarily expect that. I mean, I think that it is, in my book, lesser Coen. I feel like it was a little bit jangly, kind of going to ride off the rails a little bit, where the films of theirs that I prefer are the ones that seem very careful and intentional, even when they seem zany. But this one, you know, I think that it was just a little bit too loose for me to love it. But it is, right. It is going to beat Dawn of the Dead for me.
Yeah, the tone is kind of Looney yes. Tunesy.
Thank you.
A little bit in Raising Arizona.
Of a little bit of both of them.
Yeah.
I'm gonna speak a little bit in favor of Dawn of the Dead. I like it pretty well, actually. I think I had gotten so used to zombie films that were sort of slow and to give you time to think about the social commentary about consumerism, and, which I love. I love that. I think that's great. But this one, because it was because it did change things up, and it's a drastically different feel from the original Dawn of the Dead. And I think for that, it was a startling movie for me, but a nice startling. It wasn't like, you know, I liked that it was changing the way that the zombie films I had seen before, and putting it into this weird, like, high energy, high octane, mad, crazy, run around action flick. And it mostly worked for me. And I definitely think it's, for me, I don't know that I'd call it an unnecessary remake, because it's so different from the original that it's like, it's clearly trying to do something different with it. And even when I think those attempts fail, I'm much happier with remakes than with sequels, which in my controversial opinion.
Interesting.
But I like seeing people do a new take on something and actually do something different, as opposed to something like The Psycho, which was so similar to the original that there was not really a point to that. But so yeah, I like Dawn of the Dead. Raising Arizona, I went to check where it is on the Coen chart and on mine just because I was curious, and it is just slightly above the middle on the global and just slightly below the middle on mine, which makes sense. It's fine. It's not. It was my dad loves this movie and was like, this is, and like thought it was hilarious and showed it to me, and I was like, eh. And it doesn't, it's not as thoughtful as their good ones, and I don't think it's terribly funny. And so it doesn't do a lot for me. So I'm gonna vote for the underdog here. I'm gonna vote for Dawn of the Dead, because I was much more interested in it while I was watching it. And even though I don't think it's a brilliant, groundbreaking movie, but I think that it did something slightly different than I was expecting, and different than I had seen before in a lot of the zombie movies, and I thought it managed to do it fairly well, at least for me. It worked enough for me.
Yeah, one thing that I didn't know about the Dawn of the Dead remake is that it was written by James Gunn, who's gone on to do other things.
That feels right. Yeah. that feels like it makes sense.
Yep. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense for the tone of it, the sort of tongue-in-cheek kind of comedic element to it.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, I guess we are going to go Dawn of the Dead over Raising Arizona. Okay, next up we have The Wrestler against Lucky Number 11. Not Lucky Number 7. Slevin.
Slurring your words.
So Slevin is a strange film from 2006 that was trying very hard to be Pulp Fiction, I think. It's got Morgan Freeman, and it's got Stanley Tucci and Josh Hartnett. I think Ben Kingsley's in it. There's a big ensemble cast. Bruce Willis is in it, and it's kind of a fun little action thriller comedy, told out of sorts with a twist. It's interesting, but it's a little bit too look at me, I can do what everybody else is doing kind of a movie. Whereas The Wrestler, from 2008, it's Mickey Rourke's comeback film. It's Darren Aronofsky's most gritty and raw dramatic film, I think, that he's done. to date, and it's almost entirely not about wrestling, despite the titles. Yeah. And it's really, really, really emotionally powerful. I as much as I liked Slevin when I saw it, I'm almost 100% positive that it's not a movie that holds up well over time, and it's probably a little thinner in terms of its plot mechanics than I recall. Whereas I would venture to say that The Wrestler would get better every single time you saw it. So I will go with The Wrestler. But what do you guys think of these films?
This is one of those situations where I'm a little torn as to whether I vote the way that I would on my personal chart or whether I have like a responsibility as a Flickfight podcaster to choose the one that I know is actually the better film. I know The Wrestler is a better movie. it's a better movie. Aronofsky is brilliant and does such amazing work here. And this is, I would never have thought that a movie even loosely about wrestling would be anything that could get me involved and get me interested. And they do a really good job here. And I like Slevin a lot. And I think you compare it to Pulp Fiction, but man, Slevin is not trying to say anything. and it doesn't think it has anything important to say. It's just having fun.
Yeah.
And as opposed to Tarantino, who always feels like he's also trying to have fun while also trying to make a statement. Lucky Number 11 has no such statement. It has, there's no significance there. But it's so much fun, and it's so silly, and Josh Hartnett is so much fun in it, and it's, I found it, I watched, I think, for a movie challenge, and it is delightful, and I don't think I could say any of Aronofsky movies are delightful, but I think that's not really his word.
That's not his palette.
The Wrestler's one that I think I would, The Wrestler, even though I remember really being impressed by it, is one that I've never really felt a need to go back to. It wasn't one that, a year after I left it, it didn't sit with me the way that Black Swan or Requiem or The Fountain, or I'm sure Mother will do. And it's one that made a strong impression at the beginning and then it all just left. And so I think I'm gonna have to vote my heart and go for Slevin, partly because I'm fairly certain it's not gonna win, so I feel a little better about that, because The Wrestler really is so good.
Good for you, Hannah.
Yeah.
Thanks.
now that you need my phrase. I was not particularly impressed with Lucky Number 11. I was just looking at the calendar of the movies from 06, and I see that this came out the same year as Smoke and Aces, another extremely similar film with very similar tone from a different studio. This is not a coincidence. The reason I had looked that up is because I was getting components of the plots confused between the two. They're very similar, you know, big groups of assassins, etc. My problem with Lucky Number 7 is actually Josh Hartnett's performance. Like, his character is so clever that it is unrealistic. And this coming from a guy who's a James Bond fan, right? Who is perhaps the most unrealistically clever character ever created. But like, it really annoyed me. For some reason, which I guess is, I don't know, something to do with the filmmaking aspect of it. So I'm not particularly a Lucky Number 7 fan. I'm a huge The Wrestler fan in my top 20, partly because it is perhaps the most perfectly nihilistic film ever made. Every typically applauded moral structure of society is tried by this man. Family, love, work, society, health, you know, like he's tried all of these things and they all fail him. And the only thing left for him to do is to go do this thing that everyone tells him is silly, which is to be a wrestler, you know, which is essentially like it's sort of feeding his id, right? That's the only thing left for him to do. And like, that's such an unpopular message, such a corrosive message to society that, you know, it takes a really brave director to tell a story like that. And, you know, in the hands of another actor, like, there's no way There's no way that it could be, you know, one-tenth as empathetic as he is. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, rest by a mile for me.
It would be interesting to see what Aronofsky could do with a broad comedy. Like, just to try it, just to see what comes out, you know?
I think that would be the weirdest thing we've ever seen.
Right, right. Like, it could be.
That would be. Like, right. I'm kind of
he's
fascinated.
Never even done dark comedy.
At least Kubrick tried that.
Yeah. 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 It would be completely outside of his wheelhouse, and I wonder if he'll ever go there, but we'll have to see. All right.
Well, yeah, I think if he did, so this is my take on Aronofsky. What I really love is when he does stories about people becoming like completely obsessed with things. That's what he tells obsession stories so well. So if he went comedy, like there's room for comedy in that there's something you can mine there for comedy where you see things that you can do something about somebody like getting comedically obsessed with something and building that. So I feel like that's the route it would have to go. It'd have to be like I don't know. It had to be something like that.
It feels like if it was Aronofsky doing a story about like a stand-up comedian's life, it would just be the worst. Like,
oh my
gosh.
Know,
like
the alcoholism and the pessimism. It would just be the most dark
film ever. Here's
what
I'm thinking. I'm thinking Ben Stiller as a comic book collector. All right. I think it's that sort of tone. Like, you need to center it around a personality, right? And it has this personality is going to, and the acting choices are what's going to make it funny or not. And I think there's a lot of the greatest comedies could go either way. Depending on how you tell the story, it could either be comedy or tragedy. And I think, you know, so you take an essentially tragic character, but you put it in the hands of a master comedian. And Ben Stiller is really good at that sort of thing. So, Mr. Aronofsky, if you're listening, you know, that would be our recommendation.
We have your next movie idea. Go for it.
Yeah. Either that or you do the complete opposite where you take a complete dystopian world and the darkest sets ever and just the most horrible place that a human could be and make incredibly funny situations in this locale and make it
a post-apocalyptic comedy like that. There isn't a whole lot of those. I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
Boy and His Dog is the only one I could think of, and that really wasn't funny.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's how I would foresee it working for him, but who knows? Might not ever happen. All right. Wrestler is going to beat Lucky Number 11. All right. Next up, we have Amadeus against O Brother, Where Art Thou? From 2000. So O Brother, Where Art Thou? Was Coen Brothers' comedy drama popularized bluegrass all of a sudden for a vast majority of people. It ushered in an era of color grading that feature films hadn't really tried before, where everything had a kind of a strong sepia tone. And it definitely made the movie have a very distinctive look and distinctive feel to it. Amadeus was made in 1984, and it's this grand epic scope of a film telling the story of Amadeus and his life and his trials and tribulations and his romantic interludes and all of the things that he had to deal with in his zaniness as a composer, as an artist, as a person. And it's incredibly well made. Both of these movies are incredibly well made, I would say, in their own ways. I think Amadeus is probably the grander film. It reached farther and succeeded at it, whereas O Brother is a little bit smaller in scope, a little bit quirkier, maybe not as overall memorable in terms of the story itself, but I don't know. I could be swayed either way on this one. What do you guys think first?
This is really tough. I mean, these are both incredibly fine movies that are really important to me, both of which talk about the transcendent, almost supernatural power in the case of Oh Brother, the literal supernatural power of music in order to drive the stories that we tell each other about human nature. The Amadeus is a movie that really makes it makes me kind of sick to my stomach when I watch it, in a good way, in that kind of super bittersweet way. When you the way that it ends, kind of unflinchingly shows you his kind of ignominious end. Since I've seen it the first time, over the years, as I've learned more about Mozart's actual life and his actual relationship with Salieri, I have soured ever so slightly on the film. And I've since seen the play, which is also very good. But I think that it could stand as an example of one of the most egregious fantasies about a truly great man, great men and women, that the sort of the worst parts of these people were inflated in order to make an incredible story. But I think that when that happens, there can be damage done to kind of the cultural memory of these people. I'm not like offended by it. It's not a moral, it's not necessarily a moral condemnation that I'm making of it, but it does make me enjoy it less now. You know, now that
it's no passion of the Christ.
<man. laughs> Don't get me started. And the other thing is that it's full of 1980s acting. This was when our standards were a little bit lower, I would argue. And just sort of culture-wide. And Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the story is smaller, but the performances are smaller in a good way. They are perfectly tuned to the stylized way of telling the story that they're trying to tell, with all the subtlety that needs to be put in there. For me, I'm choosing Oh Brother. I think that it's probably not going to have the legs in film history that Amadeus has had. But for me, it's exactly the kind of constantly surprising, funny, bewildering movie that I want to see.
I, again, just because I'm since we've noticed that my flick chart for the Coens is almost exactly the opposite of the Globals, I went and checked this out. It is fifth from the top in the Globals, fifth from the bottom in mine. So it's very consistent. Oh Brother is fine. I think it's another one that that I enjoyed while I was watching it, and then all of it was just gone, like maybe the next day. And it didn't make any kind of like deep impact on me. I remember thinking it was fun. I liked the inclusion of the music. The music in that is fantastic. And as a musical person who likes musical movies, that was really nice. But Amadeus is one of my absolute favorites. I think it's really fascinating because it is so. Because since the story is very, very much not true, it reads for me almost more now as like almost a fable with fictional character, with historical characters slotted
in. Right.
which is really interesting to me. And I really super duper love it. I think it's
are there any biopics at all that are completely true?
No. But this one is probably more fictionalized. Yeah,
the central
rest.
Conflict of that film is fictionalized.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's not like to the point that it's clear that Peter Schaffer, who wrote it, did not do research into this or researched it and ignored it completely. Both of which indicate to me that it's not about the history of it. It's about the idea. And
service the story.
Exactly. And I think that works really well in this case. I think it is big and down to some of the 80s acting, but for me it works. For me it ties it together in tonally. In a way that's really, it's really lovely and interesting to me, and I find it absolutely, it just gets to me. The the man who wrote the play, did another one that was also adapted to film, although not nearly as successfully, called Equus, which I also dearly love. But and I wrote a whole paper in college comparing the two of them and like their thesis and what they were saying about it, wow. about faith and about art, and it was wonderful. But it's a show that I very, very much, and a movie that I very, very much love. Incidentally, I would have loved to see the original cast of this, which was on stage. It was Ian McKellen as Salieri and Tim Curry.
Oh my God.
Which would have been, right? like that would have been so interesting. So interesting. And I really am very sad that I did not get to see that. But yeah, Amadeus has my heart. It does everything that I want it to do. So I'm voting for it over O Brother.
It does sort of feel like it's elevated to a Shakespeare tragedy of sorts in the way that it's presented.
I'm surprised that it works as well as it does on film because it feels so inherently theatrical to me.
I mean, I think a lot of it we can attribute to the music. Right, like that. His music is operatic, literally, in its emotional scope, and it continues to be. And that's why we revere him, is because like the what he was able to accomplish emotionally in his music still resonates.
I guess if for the people that when they get a matchup on Flickchart and they say, which of these movies would I rather watch now? When you're presented with a very long epic period piece against a Coen Brothers comedy, I would venture to say most people would probably pick the comedy, but maybe not. I don't know. Maybe I'm shortchanging the audience a little bit, but I think you're right. I think Amadeus is probably the better film. I think there's just more. There's something more to it that makes it feel like a more important film. And I don't know if it's just the dramatic weight of it, the sort of melodrama of it. It feels like it's just slightly elevated to me over O Brother. So it's going to get my vote. All right. So that makes Amadeus beat O Brother, Where Art Thou?
My name is Mr. Abagnale. That's Abagnale, not Abagnale, not Abagnale, but Abagnale. Now, somebody please tell me where you left off in your textbooks. Excuse me, people, if I need to ask again, I'm going to write up the entire class. Take your seats.
Chapter 7.
Will you please open your textbooks to Chapter 8? And we'll get started. Excuse me, what's your name?
Brad.
Brad, why don't you get up here in front of the class here and read conversation number 5.
Okay, it's time for the title fight. And on this episode, we are talking about Catch Me If You Can, which stars Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio and is directed by Steven Spielberg. And this sort of came in the early 2000s era of Spielberg, when he was getting away from his Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan stuff and going towards a slightly broader range. He was doing things like War of the Worlds and Terminal and kind of flip-flopping back and forth between comedies and dramas and his big epics, blockbuster type of films. And this one sort of fits kind of in between. It's kind of a comedy, kind of a drama, almost like a mystery in a little bit of a sense, but mostly just like a cat and mouse game from front to back. It's fun to watch. It's extremely well shot. The script is tight. It makes you care for all the characters and makes you feel like there is something in the way that karma works to so that people get what they deserve, but still have a second chance, if that makes any sense. I don't know. What do you guys think about Catch Me If You Can? Is it high on your charts? Are you guys big fans?
It's interesting having this one right after our discussion about Amadeus as a biopic. Because Catch Me If You Can is one that stays. I read the book that this was based off on, which was Frank Avenel's autobiography about how he did all this, and it stays fairly true to the events going on. It dramatizes some things, it adds in some characters, and creates some stronger character bonds between others. But other than that, it stays pretty close to what's talked about. And for me, the first time through, the most interesting thing to me was this plot that sounded way too wild to be true. And seeing how he got away with all these different impersonating different people and some very some peoples and some freshers that you would not have thought that he would be able to impersonate and to get away being. But it's also the second time I watched it and subsequent times, I'm really struck by. I love the tone of this movie. It's so playful and it's exactly what it needs to be. Sort of this ridiculous chase through the country trying to find this kid who is difficult to find because he's doing stuff that makes no sense and that nobody should be able to do and nobody should be able to get away with. And
right.
it's so much fun. And I think both the leads are really good in this, and it's one of my favorites of Spielberg's. I know it's high on my chart. I don't think it's in my like top 100, but I'm sure it's in like my top 250 or 300. And I just find it so much fun. And it's one that if anybody else is watching it, I will find myself sitting down and watching along with them and enjoying it no matter where the movie begins.
Yeah. Yeah. I recently started watching it. It just happened to be on television and we flipped through and came to that one. And then we just stayed there because as soon as you see one frame, it's like, this is a painting. And okay, here's another painting. Okay, here's another painting. So just on a visualist level alone, it draws you in.
Absolutely.
And then all of the acting and directing and emotional weight pulls you in further.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that this is, in a way, because of how different it is from the stereotypical Spielberg fare up until this point. I mean, I think that it's an interesting arena for us to see simpler filmmaking, arguably simpler filmmaking in the hands of someone who is as talented as he is. I think that the movie is put together extremely well. It's a Swiss watch. The editing and the way that, you know, you cut between scenes by the camera whipping sideways and then you just kind of slam into another scene, which maybe from this, they're trying to evoke film from other eras by doing that. In any case, like it's the filmmaking is what really impresses me here. The story makes me really uncomfortable. The amorality of Frank Abagnale really makes me uncomfortable. I think the problem is that I am bad at reading people just in my normal life, and so it's really easy to lie to me. So I go through life kind of on edge, because I know how easy it would be for me to kind of be taken. And then when you have someone, and then when he makes the step to start impersonating a law enforcement officer, when he pretends to be Secret Service, that's beyond the pale. So I had a really difficult time cultivating any kind of sympathy for him. And I think that what little I managed to muster up was because of Leo's amazing performance. I mean, he's so deft and light and so effortless with the components of the character. But I found it kind of an unpleasant watch, kind of like when I watched The Founder or, you know, any of these other movies that are kind of centered around, amoral people that we're supposed to enjoy to one extent or another. But again, that's not a comment on the filmmaking. That's probably comes down to a preference thing for me.
I think it's definitely to DiCaprio's credit that I don't feel that way about it. he plays the character for me with enough stupid youth, the amorality of a teenager.
Right. Right.
who has in many ways not learned how to think outside of this is what will get me what I want. And plays it with enough of that
he sells
it's
it.
Easier for me to find the sympathy and to think, okay, I think that there's hope for him. That there's hope for him to be like, oh wait, maybe this is not something I should do.
And then you get that satisfying moment
going on that it overrides that for me, because that should be something that should bother me, and for whatever reason it doesn't in this, and I think I credit that to DiCaprio.
Yeah,
I think Tom Hanks has a lot to do with it too, in terms of like his character sets the audience at ease a lot, because you know he's not a abrasive guy, he's not a gruff. Special agent or anything like that. He's not the typical guy. He's kind of bookwormy. He's not really liked by his peers. He just wants to, you know, do good and get the bad guy and bring him in. And it has nothing to do with what he feels like. You know, he doesn't judge. He doesn't think that he's a bad guy necessarily. He just knows that, you know, he's done something wrong and it's illegal and he needs to be, you know, pulled in for it.
Can't do it anymore.
And I love the relationship that they have as they grow and they almost become father son because of Frank Abagnale's sort of absentee father figure of Christopher Walken not really being there for him and him having to deal with his mother and her infidelity and all this stuff. It's like, it's just such a nice web of interpersonal dynamics between characters, which is interesting, and it keeps you engaged with the emotional component of what Frank Abagnale is doing. Like, he's not ever doing it because he wants to be, you know, a criminal necessarily. He's just doing it because he feels like that's what he's good at, and he can find a way to make things work for everyone around him if he continues to do it. So.
Yeah, it's that sort of effortlessness that sort of he didn't really make the decision. Like, this is just what he's built to do, and he doesn't know what else to do. I think I might almost prefer him to have been malicious. I think because then the good and evil set, like, then like kind of the thrust of the story would be a little more predictable. Or alternatively, he has some really strong moral reason for committing all of these sins. You know, trying to raise money for cancer treatment or something like that. You know, that would have kind of sucked all the blood out of the plot. But then, you know, I would have been on board with it at least. Yeah. And,
right.
I think, again, this is just my own personality, but I think that may have been what kind of made my blood run so cold about him is that it really wasn't anything that he debated. You know,
there's a little bit of a sociopath kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to think about whether this is a problem or not. I'm not even going to consider this. This is something I can do, so I'm going to.
Right.
So I can totally see that.
One thing that I found interesting is I just recently watched the Spielberg documentary that's on HBO. When Spielberg was younger, probably almost the same age as Frank Abagnale, his mother cheated on his dad with another man and left and, you know, left his father. And then so there was this weirdness at that point where the you know, he resented the father and there was all this weirdness where he wanted the father to be back with the mother. It's like there's so many similarities between Spielberg's personal life and Abagnale's life, the character, and the real life Abagnale's character, real life Abagnale's life.
Wow, that's really interesting.
That it was probably like a no-brainer for Spielberg to say, oh yeah, I know how to do this. I live this, you know. I'm not as criminal as Abagnale, but he knows from an emotional standpoint what he was trying to accomplish with all of his craziness that he was up to. So yeah, interesting movie. Well done. Cool. So let's put it on the chart then and see how it fares. So the first movie it's up against is My Big Fat Greek Wedding,
which I haven't seen.
It belongs right about in the middle of a chart. It's fine. It's serviceable. It's enjoyable while you watch it. It's not exciting or special. And Catch Me If You Can is a much more creative movie on like every level.
Yeah. I would agree with all that. So now Catch Me If You Can is going up against Good Will Hunting. Academy Award winning Good Will Hunting.
Yeah, I found Good Will Hunting a little bit exhausting to get through at times, but I think I am going to choose it over Catch Me If You Can. I think that, I don't know, I felt a little bit better about a lot of the characters, and the story was a little more down to earth.
I think I'm going Catch Me If You Can. I liked Good Will Hunting, but it was one of those movies where I finished watching it and I was not entirely sure how much of what I liked about it was. I felt very, very aware of its Oscar-ness.
Definitely.
And I was to the point where I had trouble separating it out afterwards from like what I genuinely enjoyed and what I felt like. That doesn't happen very often, that I feel like super pressured to like a movie to the point where it changes my opinion of it. But yeah. I felt genuinely a little disoriented after that because I could not separate what I liked and what I was told to like.
Right, that's a Jedi mind trick hangover.
It was. So I think it was good, but I'm voting for Catch Me If You Can because I know I like that one for itself.
There are definitely some Oscar Beatty movies that feel like they're over the top, making you feel something. Mm-hmm. Like they're crafted in such a way that the emotional takeaway is forced.
Oh yeah, it emotionally intrusive is the phrase I use.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like, you know, I did like Good Will Hunting though. I watched it, I enjoyed it, I felt like the performances were good. But it's in the script, really. I mean, it's not necessarily that it's full of fine acting. It's more.
Yeah, that's a good distinction.
That the script could be done by probably any good, competent actor and be just as strong.
I would buy that for sure.
Whereas in Catch Me If You Can, I don't know if it would work with a different cast.
I don't think so much
of it resides on Leo's performance being pitch perfect and Hank's being that counterbalance. So I don't know that it would work any other way. So I think I'll go Catch Me If You Can. Okay, now we've got Catch Me If You Can up against Apocalypse Now. Well, I'm going to say that Doug is going to go Apocalypse Now, and Hannah's going to go Catch Me If You Can. And I'm going to go...
Eventually, we might need to show up. This is great.
Nathan, you don't even need us. You'll just be like, so,
yeah.
How is this going?
I think Apocalypse Now is the more accomplished work. There's just more... As visually spectacular as Catch Me If You Can is, it is absolutely trounced by Apocalypse Now when it comes to its visuals. So even on a purely visual standpoint, I can't say that there's anything in Catch Me If You Can that is going to be better than Apocalypse Now. So it has to win on that just alone. Not to mention everything else that it has going for it. So, but I don't know. Do you guys want to try to convince each other that you're wrong?
I'm not going to be able to. It's just Francis Ford Coppola is clearly speaking in a different language than I am. Like, his film language is so far removed from mine that I watch it and I don't understand a single thing of why people are doing what they're doing or what he's trying to say.
Yeah, his language is called the 70s.
But I've seen, I don't feel that about that about every director. And so it's Coppola. So I'm very willing to believe he's a very good filmmaker. I just can't I can't interpret what he's saying. Mm-hmm. And so it's complete gibberish to me. So I'm voting for Catch Me If You Can, because Spielberg is speaking to me in a way I understand.
That's well articulated. And
Francis Ford Coppola's gibberish Vietnam movie can win.
Oh, sure.
But
yeah.
I don't get it.
Yeah. Great. Nothing to add. Perfect sum up.
Okay. All right. Apocalypse Now is going to be Catch Me If You Can. Oh. Now we got Catch Me If You Can up against The Mask.
That was an involuntary eel reaction to The Mask. So I guess you know which way I'm voting now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm picking The Mask. Man, I love The Mask. The Mask is surprising and wonderful and full of joy in ways that Catch Me If You Can is not for me.
We're definitely finding that Doug, he has a thing against movies that don't make you feel good.
Guilty?
Mask didn't make me feel good.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. Yeah, my pleasure centers are just differently arranged than other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's probably a more accurate representation. Okay, so Hannah, I imagine you're going Catch Me If You Can.
Absolutely.
Yes?
There's nothing about The Mask that I like.
I'm lukewarm on The Mask, whereas I think my burner's a little hotter on Catch Me If You Can. So
if The Mask came on halfway through on TV, would you watch the whole thing through?
Probably not.
I don't know. That might have been a badge.
Now we're up against GoldenEye.
Which I haven't seen.
I have seen it. It's good. I mean, in terms of new Bond actor debuts, it's pretty darn good. I enjoy it a lot. I'm voting it.
I would say there's probably at least half dozen Bond movies that I would like more than GoldenEye. So sure. I think I'll agree, Catch Me If You Can. Catch Me If You Can against Dark City.
Dark City deserves a rewatch from me. I don't have strong enough memories of it to vote it against something that I really love. So I'm definitely voting Catch Me If You Can here, but it's possible that I'm not giving Dark City its due by dismissing it so quickly.
Yeah, it's probably not the better technical achievement, but it is more interesting overall, I'd say. More artistically reaching, more intellectual, more unique. But I don't know if it's better. What do you say, Doug?
I think I'm voting Catch Me If You Can in this case. The problem I had with Dark City was a little bit, I mean, Catch Me If You Can is more coherent. Dark City is not incoherent in the typical use of the word, but it, I think that its main, the body of the story and the world that it was trying to tell, it really didn't come together until the end. And then the end was a little bit ambiguous anyway. And I felt like there was, the purpose of the story and the characters was to show us this amazing world and to ask all these really interesting questions. But I think that that's kind of fundamentally not as interesting as like telling a story, you know. So
Okay, so it's the lack of resolution and sort of vagueness of it that turns you off a little bit more than
necessarily anti-vagueness. Maybe there was other parts of Dark City that they didn't manage to kind of sell me on kind of taking the ride with them. As much as I know some people are like super into it.
It's definitely a movie where they just throw you in.
Sure.
You know, there's no getting your feet wet in Dark City. It's like you're just in this incredibly strange
circumstance. It's a film noir. It's told backwards.
Immediately. Yeah. 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 It's the neo-noir, as they call it.
Neo-neo-noir.
Okay, well, I think you probably convinced me that maybe Catch Me If You Can should win here. So It will. And now it goes up against The Goonies, which is in my top 20.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. Love The Goonies.
Yeah.
Did you ever notice that during the first bike sequence, there's a house that's on fire that they bike past, that they don't really mention it? It's like they're like biking through the town and they pass this house where there's smoke just pouring out of this house. And they just, next time you watch it, watch, there's like a house, there's people, there's like a really serious house fire that's been caught on camera.
Is it in the sequence where they're on their bikes and it's with where it like intercut with the Fratellis doing their escape sequence, or is it a different sequence?
It's the one where they escape from Brandt. They tied up Brandt and they're shooting, going on their bikes. Audience, let me know if I'm wrong.
I've never noticed that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. I'll have to look out for that next time. I've seen it at least half a dozen times and I don't think I've ever seen that. Huh. Hannah, are you a gooner? Goonies?
No, I would rather watch the movie about the house fire. So no, Goonies.
You're the adult that doesn't get the obnoxious children.
I don't like any of the characters, and I don't think that the adventure it's not interesting to me, and it's one that I think to get anything out of it, I would have had to watch it much younger than I did. And even then, I don't know if it would have stuck with me. But
why do we love it so much, Doug? How do we convey to people how amazing it is compared to?
I did.
Almost every other adventure film.
Right. Here's for me, the moment is the "This is our time" speech, where there was the sense when I was a child that I still kind of get, but my memory of childhood was about there really wasn't our time for me. I didn't have a time where I was empowered in order to make a difference in the world of adults, my childhood was characterized by just that feeling of impotence in this world that expected more of me constantly. And so what was playing out on the screen for me in Goonies is sort of a realization, this we're going to wish fulfillment of, like, yes, that they're still children. They're still, their value proposition is that they are children, and it is in their childness that gives them the power in order to exact the change that they want to see in the world. They don't have to grow up, right? Like, they just need to apply their normal childnesses to the problems that they see in the world, and they are able to help. They're able to, you know, exact change to the world instead of just being, you know, completely helpless.
Yeah. There's so many films in the 80s that feel like that take that stance, mm-hmm. that adults are less than competent.
Yeah. And why won't they believe me? There's vampires everywhere.
Yeah, and children can somehow save the day and be the heroes. And I don't know why in the 90s, in the 2000s, and now there are just so few movies that have strong kid hero characters. Right. Like they don't exist that I can think of where they have that sort of dichotomy of parents that are sort of just slightly on the bumbling side, and the kids are actually able to come together, formulate a plan, execute the plan, save the day. It's like, it's almost like a reverse Die Hard kind of situation where instead of John McClane, you know, being the cop out of water, it's the kids are the ones that are in that position where this crazy circumstance occurs, and they're the only ones that can, you know, figure out a solution. I don't know. That's what, to me, the Goonies is all about. It's not about, you know, the kids being obnoxious. It's not about, you know, their adventure being incredibly unrealistic. It's all about just the fact that they are able to somehow come together and make it work.
Now you both got me thinking whether there's like got me thinking about whether the me as a child and the way that I saw the world as a child, if there's like a fundamental disconnect for me there. because I definitely did not have like a sense of adventure as a child. I was the older sister tasked with taking care of the younger ones sometimes, and I was the babysitter, and so I was always like extremely aware of all the horrible things that could go wrong. I was an oldest child with anxiety, and so everything could go wrong all the time. Mm-hmm. And so
you were the Josh Brolin character, wanting all the kids to stay home.
And so I wonder now, honestly, it made me wonder if this wouldn't have been appealing to me even as a child, because it would have felt
foreign.
Yeah, it would have felt foreign, and I wouldn't have And even now, I've like my adventures that I have are small adventures, and I've never had a desire to save the world in a big dramatic way. And so I'm wondering if there is. Yeah, if this is playing into a childhood fantasy that I simply never had, because that would make sense.
Maybe.
Have you seen Stranger Things?
I have seen Stranger Things.
Do you find a similar disconnect there?
I like the kids more. I like the kids as characters more.
Yeah, they're certainly better actors.
Actually, I started thinking about it in terms of Super 8.
Right. Yeah. Essentially
but that one yeah. where there's clearly, kids out saving the world. But the thing that I remember from Super 8 is the connection and the bonding with the alien at the end.
Right.
And so I think that's probably speaking maybe to my primary childhood desire was not so much to save the world as to just connect with somebody and just to have friends to have a friend.
Yeah, you know what?
I'm wondering if those are the things that I connect to more than that. I don't want to go out and have adventures with my friends.
I mean, this sounds like a really clear gender dynamic to me. It seems like the things that the boys were wanting when we were kids is very different from the things that the girls were wanting. And we really do fall into some pretty, pretty solid stereotypes of our genders. So good job, everyone.
Yay, us. and that's very possible.
All right, so let's see. Next up, we've got Catch Me Up If You Can up against Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Oh yeah, Last Crusade,
which is still
definitely
still in the top 20 of all time, according to
Last Crusade in the chart. Top 20. I always forget that. Yeah, that was startling to me. Like, not that it's not good. It's just that seems like a lot.
It seems like a lot. It does indeed. Yeah, I would go Catch Me If You Can.
I think I'm also going to go Catch Me If You Can simply by virtue of it being the first and not a sequel.
And these are both Spielberg.
They are. They are both so fun, though. But I think I'm going to go Catch Me If You Can. I think that one has... I think Catch Me If You Can has a little bit more emotional weight to the characters. It's not just an adventure.
I've got to rewatch Crusade because I haven't seen it since 89. And everybody seems to just think it's the dog's bollocks. And I have no idea why. There's got to be something there I'm missing. Okay. Catch Me If You Can is 66 on the chart. And that's out of 491 movies. Almost to 500. Nice.
It's pretty high.
Yeah. So it's pretty high up there. All right. Well, that's another episode of Flick Fights in the Can. So if you want to follow our chart's progress, you can find us as Flick Fights on Flickchart. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook. And if you want to follow all of the guests that we've had on the show in the past and be a guest on our show yourself, just send us an email to flickfights@flickchart.com and we'll get you on the show. And from all of us at Flick Fights, thanks for listening and we'll talk to you soon.